Hello and welcome to Oxford Today on Oxide Radio. Today on the show I have the Reverend Nick King, a tutor and fellow in New Testament studies at Campion Hall, a Jesuit hall at the University of Oxford. Now, Father Nick has a very interesting story to tell. He's been all over the world and has also done many different things which are quite revolutionary actually for culture and society and for how we look at the Bible and look at different issues with religious studies in schools and higher education. So I'm delighted to welcome Father Nick to the show.
Thank you very much.
So perhaps the best place to start with you, Father Nick, is your early life, starting at the beginning of the story. Because when you first came up to Oxford, notably on your profile, it says that you wanted to be a wealthy barrister. You were obviously religious. You had some sort of faith before coming up. But that changed within a matter of minutes or something, apparently.
Well, fairly soon in my first year. As I say, I was reading greats, and in those days it was quite normal to go on to the bar, and that's what I wanted to do. Some people say I wanted the chance to show off. But at a particular moment that I can date to within a few minutes, I just knew, beyond any shadow of doubt, that what I had to do, if I was going to be happy, was to join these Jesuits who taught me at school, whom I had no intention of joining when I left the place.
Why was that then? Why was the sudden change of heart then?
I really don't quite know. I'd done a lot of debating as a schoolboy, and so it was a natural thing to join the union. And I spoke a little bit in the union, but I got a little bit disillusioned because people weren't really doing what I would call debating there. So if someone on the Labour side had to speak in favour of the Conservatives, he would apologise for that. And I don't think you do that. I think debating, you make the best of whatever case is assigned to you. So I was a bit disillusioned with that, but quite suddenly it came to me, and I just knew it was right. I wasn't wondering, what shall I do? I knew what to do. But it happened, and that's well over 50 years ago, and so far I've seen no reason to change my mind.
And then, talking about your family background then, you obviously went to sort of you had a religious upbringing, and you were taught by Jesuits in school.
Yeah.
What impact did that have on you then?
Very hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, it's bound to have had some impact. I noticed that all my siblings continue to be practicing Catholics. So it did something for us, and we all went through the same sort of education. And I think for each of us, probably in quite different ways, it matters quite a lot. And certainly, as far as I can see, it's a way to sanity.
And then, with the work of the Jesuits then, you're based in Campion Hall. Many young people, perhaps, of a different generation, even different Catholics, perhaps, generally, perhaps don't see the work of the Jesuits as often as they used to, and, you know, many perhaps aren't taught by Jesuits in schools anymore.
No, that's true. We used to have 7 or 8 schools in this country. We still run the schools, but very few of them have Jesuits in them, and Jesuits aren't in the way that they once were. I think you're absolutely right. Of course, there's some very pleasing 16th century propaganda against us, which regards us as sinister and liars and all sorts of things like that. But even that's gone by the board a bit.
And why do you think then that the Jesuits are not in schools anymore then? Is it because of that propaganda, or is it just a gradual change?
I think there have been changes. We've lost numbers. We're getting old and grey, and that means we haven't got as many as we used to spare to teach in schools. And I think there's a loss there. I think, like many others, we lost our nerve a bit over the child abuse scandal. We suffered a bit from that, not as badly as some others, but we did suffer, and that made us a bit nervous about it. So now our work with young people is more in university chaplaincies, like here at Oxford or in Manchester University.
And do you see a new generation then of Jesuits or Catholics coming up with different ideas than yourself then?
I hope so, yes. I mean, because old fuddy-duddies like myself must be replaced. That's very important. I'm very impressed with the young people I see here in Oxford. You know, you read the writings of the literati and you'll think there's no religion left in this country or in France. Well, I know both places reasonably well, and in neither case is that true. You get some highly intelligent people of great quality who are quite serious about religion, but not the majority, obviously, and numbers are much less than they were 50 years ago.
And obviously that could be linked to a broader shift in disaffection with religion and with different beliefs. Is there any way that you and the work that you do in Campion Hall and with young people, is there a way that you found to engage people generally in believing in some sort of faith and engaging with the work that you do.
I think one other thing we have to do is to talk human. I mean, a great danger if you're religious is that you talk a language that no one understands. And we're getting a great example of that just at the moment from Pope Francis in Rome. He talks human language. He talks a language that any Argentinian housewife can easily understand. Mm. Maybe we've got to learn that skill.
And is that not something that happens as often then in Britain specifically then, or just generally around the world that you've seen now? Because there's now been, even looking at the work of Justin Welby in this country, what he does, he is seen to be more human than previously. Yeah. Is that something that you think a new generation can take on as well?
I think it is, and I look at the young people in Oxford, and I think they can make sense of that. Mm. And in many cases, and this is a contrast to when I was teaching here 10 or so years ago, I think undergraduates are really quite interested in religion. They don't know anything about it. But as opposed to 10 years ago, they're not angry against it. They think there might be something in it, and they'd like to know a bit more.
And then talking about some of the adventures you've been on as well. Mm. You've been... Well, you went to South Africa for a long period of time. Tell us briefly about that. What happened there?
Well, it was one of the most extraordinary times of my life. I was there for 13 years. When I arrived, the authorities made it difficult for me because they thought Catholic priests were communists because they were against apartheid. And people were writing letters to the newspapers saying, this Nelson Mandela, he's a communist traitor and they should hang him. Well, they don't write letters like that any longer. So I was there from that moment of grand apartheid to our present democratic arrangement, which isn't without its problems, but it's an enormous improvement on what it was like. And I had the great privilege of being a district observer for our first democratic elections in April 1994. So I had to drive round 7 polling stations in the Natal Midlands, pretending to a knowledge of South African law that I certainly didn't possess. Mm. And it was just great to be alive on that day and to watch black people and white people queuing in the sun and getting to know each other in a way they hadn't done before.
Have you been back since then?
I've been back 2 or 3 times just to give lectures and so on. And it's interesting. I was there, I think 2 years ago was the last time, and people were, not surprisingly, complaining about 1 or 2 aspects of what's happened. And I said, look, 21 years ago, if you had been told this is where South Africa will be 21 years from now, you'd have said, we'll accept that. Mm. And I think it's true. And the country isn't a complete shambles, as people claimed it would be, and some think it now is.
And then looking at your work then as a Jesuit there, because obviously you saw what was happening there in 1994, but your actual work there, before that time, what were you actually doing there?
I was teaching in seminaries and universities and doing academic administration, so I was dean in a couple of seminaries, that sort of thing. My students were almost entirely black. Mm. It was very interesting because it was absolutely clear what the church had to do. There was one objective, and that is we get rid of apartheid. That was the only thing that really mattered, and that was what all our work was directed towards. After liberation, or after the democratic elections, it became a bit more complicated. And they were then inclined to say, well, what are you as a white man doing as our academic dean? We should have a black man. And I had a lot of sympathy with that.
Mm. And has that been reflected in what's happened since then?
To some extent it has, yes, yes. Although, African people are much more patient than white people, and they're much more forgiving too.
Mm. And then, I suppose now looking back at the recent controversies in South Africa and generally in Southern Africa as a whole now, what role can religion, faith, the values associated with it do there? And generally political sort of difficulties anyway, because there's obviously a fine line that we see in this country as well, whether religious figures should intervene or comment.
Yeah.
What do you see as that role generally? But also,
well, the old South African government, the National Party, used to summon church leaders and read to them from Romans chapter 13, which says you've got to obey the man in charge. And that, because that's what the gospel says, or what the Bible says. I think the church does have something to offer, and it's something like the ability to listen to all sides. That's really important. On the whole, if you're in a political party, it's not your task to listen. Your task is to say, this is what we're going to do. But that quality of listening, which the church does have at its best, not at its worst, is something that we have to offer in difficult situations.
Perhaps what you're most well known for is your translation of the Bible, and from Greek into English.
Yes.
Explain. You take this from me then, because it seems like one of the most mammoth tasks that one could undertake. Yes. Tell us the story behind that. What motivated you to do that?
Well, I was just asked to do it, and I didn't for a moment think that I would live to complete it.
Mm. When did you start this then? When was this?
It was about 2001. I finished in South Africa, and I was sent here to Oxford to start teaching here in the theology faculty. And because of the way the academic year in South Africa ends in November, I didn't get here till December. By then, of course, the Oxford year is halfway over, so I didn't have very much teaching to do. But I was due to go and give a workshop on Mark's Gospel and John's Gospel in the United States that summer. So I did what I'd always wanted to do, and I sat down and translated those two Gospels, Mark and John, just for my own interest, cutting out punctuation and cutting out verses and chapters, because those are medieval inventions. And, well, that was that. Very interesting. So what do you do when you've got a translation? Well, what I did was I was giving another summer school in the north of England, and this was on Mark's Gospel, and I said, look, I've done this translation. It might help you thinking about what we're discussing this week. And as it turned out, the wife of a chap who'd published some of my stuff before was a member of the class. And so the next thing I knew, he was on the phone. Kevin Mayhew is his name. And he said, Nick, will you translate the whole Bible? And I said, no, there's absolutely no question of that. I mean, I couldn't possibly. I'm far too old, and I would never finish. But he was very persistent. So I said, well, look, all right, what I'll do, and this is all I'm going to do, is to translate the New Testament. And I thought that would take the rest of my life. So I did that, and it took, I suppose, about 4 years, and I really enjoyed the experience. I learned a lot from doing it, and it helped my teaching here at the university, and he published it very beautifully. But on the back page of the New Testament is written, you know, they have to write a series of lies about how wonderful the author is. The biggest lie was the last sentence, and he knew this wasn't true. He is currently working on a translation of the Old Testament.
Brilliant.
Well, I suppose so. So I saw this and I sulked a bit. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. I mean, I really didn't see any possibility. But after a bit, I thought, well, why not? And I spoke to my provincial. He's the boss of the Jesuits in England. And said, what do you think about it? And he said, well, it's all right. It'll keep you off the streets, won't it? So I did. I set off to do it. And to my astonishment, eventually, after about 13 years, it got done. And one evening I came down to supper at Campion Hall and said to the master next to whom I was sitting, I said, I think I've just finished translating the Bible. It was extraordinary. And I really didn't think I would live to do it, because there's a lot of the Bible. I don't know if you've noticed.
What are the processes then that you go through? Because obviously you talk about you did those sort of Gospels for, sort of like, for your own interest, for fun, you enjoyed it. Do you sit somewhere and you sit there for, you know, a period of 10, 12 hours and just read and translate?
No.
Because the grammar and, you know, all these different medieval things that you've talked about.
Yeah.
How does it actually work? Because it's baffling to most people. You know, how would it actually work then?
Well, I've worked a long time among Zulus, and I greatly admire them. And their motto is shoot first, then ask questions. And I think I've been influenced by them. So my translation, I think I just do it. I sit at the computer. And very often it's the kind of thing I found I could do between lectures or tutorials. Mm. So if I had a few minutes to spare, I could go up to my computer and sit down and just do one verse and do that. And very often I found I could remember what I was doing. And then during the rest of the day, you get ideas coming. Maybe I should have done that. And so I'd always go back and look. Mm. And then I had two excellent copy editors who pick me up on points that I got wrong and so on.
Mm. And is it also then, just in terms of the linguistic aspect, is it difficult to interpret things as well when you're looking at the original copy and then how you're translating it into how you would think now differently, or, you know, by literally translating it?
Yeah. I mean, the Italians have a wonderful expression for it, as for so many things. They say, traduttore, traditore. If you translate, you're a traitor, because you actually can't translate. You always fail, including my own translation, is a failure in certain respects, because you can never get it right. Mm. But it's always worth making the attempt.
And then what was the reception like then for other people when you told the master that you translated the Bible?
Yeah.
Looking at other Jesuits around the country, What was their reaction?
Well, they're very...
very proud of you, I can
imagine. Well, they're very kind about it, anyway. some of the more irreverent said, well, we've heard of the King James Version, now we've got the King Nick Version of the Bible. and when it was published on the whole, reviewers have been quite kind.
And looking at the impact that's had then, the translating it, that's one step, perhaps, you could say, is making it more accessible, perhaps?
I suppose so. I mean, that's one of the things that translation does, isn't it? You make it accessible to a new generation. And, of course, 50 years from now, they'll be scratching their heads and saying, why on earth did he translate it in that sort of way? Because language moves on.
Do you think it's just the language side, then, that people will think, oh, that's why...
Well, there's both language and culture. Though the Bible has this extraordinary freshness and its ability to come alive in different generations. And in that respect, I think the Bible is quite unlike any other literary work.
And when you started translating it then, did your own ideas and perceptions of what you had read previously change?
Inevitably, but of course what you're not always quite clear about is to what extent you've got stuff in your memory, because, you know, I know all these texts in various different versions, and how much of that has already influenced me. It's great to have the texts open in front of you, and in the Old Testament, which is originally Hebrew, I've got my computer was able to have the Greek and then below it the Hebrew, so I could see at a glance what they'd done with it, which is very interesting.
You talk about how stimulating it was as well. What particular aspects of it or readings that you thought was particularly interesting to you then? Just so it's...
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, there were all sorts of freshnesses that came to me, all sorts of moments at which I thought, I've never thought of that. And then occasionally, gosh, that's really rather good. Not many people know the book of Leviticus, but there's a whole series of regulations in it. And actually, first time you look at it, it seems rather dull. But if you're working on it as a translation, it's absolutely fascinating. And just getting the whole context together, it's not a series of thou shalt nots. It's how are we going to live a sensible life that makes sense in our context?
Do you think then, as well, looking at those specific aspects of, you know, how we live our lives and whatever, in terms of where we are now in society, generally, politically, culturally, socially, are those the most relevant, you think, to when you look back now and what you look at with the Bible and looking at society now and the way you perceive it and the way I perceive it?
It's tricky to use that word relevant too easily, I think. But I think the Bible has the gift for challenging you and biting you in the ankle in unexpected ways. A text that you thought you knew quite well suddenly speaks to you in this situation here in Oxford today. And I found that again and again.
So you talk about what will happen in, like, 50, 100 years' time. First of all, do you think there will be other translations? And second of all, is there another way or different ways that we can make texts like the Bible, or there's not many, but texts such as the Bible, more accessible to people digitally and things like that, all those different aspects you can look at?
I think that's true. I think when people get to know the Bible, rather than thinking that they know the Bible, they actually scratch their heads and find, well, actually, this is quite relevant to my situation. And what you've got there is below the surface of the text, in ways which are very hard to define or understand, you've got the voice of the Creator God saying, this is my universe and this is how to operate within it.
And I think I'm right in saying that you've actually been involved in looking at how religious studies is taught in schools as well.
I've done a bit of that. I mean, I have taught in schools. I wrote the draft of a book on how to read some of the Gospels in school. And I find that very interesting because young people are wonderful. They're very sharp, very perceptive, and ask really quite alarming questions, which are very good for the elderly like myself to have to face.
What did you see then, drafting that book and working in schools, how religious studies is taught? Do you think it's being taught in the right way, not even just generally, but specific aspects of religion, different religions? Because I remember when I was educated in, you know, religious studies, I don't remember it being very scintillating and interesting for me. I don't think the curriculum was like that. But
when I was at school, I was driven mad with boredom by most of the RE classes. I mean, I just couldn't make out what was going on.
Has that changed now, then, do you think, of just what your experience
is? Well, I think it varies, to be perfectly honest. And I think in some places it's done extremely well. The difficulty is there are fewer and fewer people qualified to teach religious studies or theology. And that makes a problem. So people get made to do it who have got no experience. They may have some kind of religious faith, but that doesn't give you a qualification in teaching it. And young people, very perceptive as they are, demand a sensible introduction to this kind of stuff, because they can dimly see the importance of it. But if you teach it like a left boot, then that's not going to be any good at all.
Aside from school, then, we've talked about how you can make things more accessible generally, the work of the Jesuits and your own research. Not just looking at an education, then, how can young people actually engage with RE religious studies outside of that? Because we've seen, you know, we talk about the role of the church. What is the role and maybe the responsibility of young people? How can they engage with it?
I think it's immense. The young people who are listening to this programme, no doubt, eagerly, they're the ones who are going to change our world. And they've got to take their task seriously. And they need a set of ideas that are going to help them to do that. And I think in the Bible, that's on offer. Mm. On the whole, young people today, for various quite understandable reasons, don't know the Bible all that well. I think it wouldn't do badly if they were to do that. And how would they start? Here's the thing. You know, people are terrified of the Old Testament. Some people say, well, it's all about making the world in 6 days, which simply means they haven't bothered to read more than about a chapter of it. A place to start for me would be the Psalms, a series of 150 poems of every kind of mood. You've got a mood for everything, any mood that you may have on you at the moment. And just open the Psalms and let it speak to you and let the poetry speak. So I think young people can be very moved by that stuff.
Mm. Looking back to where we are now in Oxford and your work in Campion Hall now, what do you try and do every day when you go into Campion Hall?
Because you obviously start, well, I live at Campion Hall.
What do you try and do every day in Campion? Sort of, you know, your ethos and teaching and learning and
gosh,
what is the? Because when you wake up and you go in there and you have, we've talked about these issues that we have, the challenges, and also I assume there's also many opportunities as well.
There are. I'm just trying to think what I've done this morning. We have an hour's prayer first thing in the morning, and then I had appointments and interviews with someone who's an American academic, and then someone who needed some help in translating some Greek, and then I can't remember what I did. Oh, yes, then I'd been trying to write something, and when the bell wasn't ringing or the phone wasn't going, so writing some academic articles.
So it's a varied life as well, then?
It's a very varied life, yeah, and occasionally people want, because I'm also an assistant chaplain here, they want to come for a spiritual chat or to make a confession or something like that. So it's quite varied.
Do you think then as well, as I've mentioned a few times now, in the society we live in, that's looking to people such as yourself for those discussions, for those insights, those thoughts, that poetry you've just discussed now, it's not a matter of escapism, it's a matter of actually trying to process things as well.
Yeah, it's dealing with the real world. Poetry does that, prayer does that, and young people know the need to deal with the real world, and they want something that'll help sort out their world for them.
Father Nick, thank you very much for your time. That's all we've got time for this evening on Oxford Today. This episode will also be on the iTunes store. I'm sure Father Nick will be listening to that on there. But it'll also be on our website on oxfordradio.live. We'll be back next week for another episode. But this has been such a scintillating discussion covering all different aspects of Father Nick's career and experiences, but also his beliefs as well. So I'm very grateful to him for coming in to the show. But for me, Father Nick, and everybody here at Oxford Today, goodbye.